From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the crisis in northern Iraq. Israel-Hamas truce appears to be holding. Africa's Ebola outbreak, plus new information about Robin Williams' suicide. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Embattled two-term Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he is stepping aside and will support his nominated replacement, Haider al-Abadi. Mr. Maliki, under enormous international pressure to step down, announced his decision late Thursday. His resignation comes just 3 days after he defiantly took to the airwaves to announce he would not accept the Abadi nomination. Mr. Maliki and his backers argue that he was entitled to the nomination by law because his political bloc is the largest in parliament. Meantime, the United Nations has announced that the situation in Iraq is a level 3 emergency. This development will allow for additional assistance to the many people who have fled their homes seeking safety from the onslaught of the Islamic State militants. Stefan Jurdiuk is the UN spokesperson. He spoke with reporters Thursday in New York.
The Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson today met with Bishop Sarhad Jamo and Bishop Francis of Iraq's American Christian community, leading a delegation of Iraqi Christian representatives and community leaders from throughout the United States. The Deputy Secretary General recognized the serious plight of the religious minorities in Iraq at the hands of the so-called Islamic State forces. He expressed his deep compassion for the victims and affected communities. The Deputy Secretary General assured the delegation that the United Nations is now taking urgent humanitarian action, and he also underlined the need for global solidarity and support to address the needs of those impacted communities.
And Kieran Dwyer, spokesperson for the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, he spoke Thursday about the plight of the people who sought refuge on Mount Sinjar in northern Iraq.
We know there are still people on the mountain. It's an extremely difficult condition. They fled to that mountain because it's not safe from in their homes. And we need to continue to assess and support immediate life-saving needs and to see what can be done to enable them to move from there to a safe and secure location.
Since June, Iraq has been facing an onslaught by the Islamic State militants and allied Sunni militants across much of the country's north as well as the west. Thousands of people have been killed and more than 1.5 million people displaced by the violence. Some 45,000 people, members of the Yazidi religious minority, were able to escape from a remote desert mountaintop where they had been encircled by Islamic State fighters who view them as apostates and had vowed to kill them if they did not convert to Islam. Here in the U.S., President Obama says he's winding down evacuation efforts as conditions are improving on Iraq's Mount Sinjar. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez has our report.
President Obama, speaking to reporters while on vacation in the northeastern U.S. state of Massachusetts, said U.S. forces have continued to make progress in getting help to the thousands of people who have been trapped on Mount Sinjar in northern Iraq. A team of American military and civilians has reviewed the conditions on the mountain, and President Obama said things have improved enough to scale back the mission.
Because of these efforts, we do not expect there to be an additional operation to evacuate people off the mountain, and it's unlikely that we're going to need to continue humanitarian airdrops on the mountain. The majority of the military personnel who conducted the assessment will be leaving Iraq in the coming days.
Since last Friday, the U.S. military has dropped 114,000 meals and more than 130,000 liters of fresh water on the mountain, where members of the Yazidi religious minority have sought refuge from Sunni militants threatening to exterminate them. President Obama said U.S. warplanes also have struck targets of the Islamic State group, also known as ISIL, to enable thousands of refugees to leave the mountain safely. The president said U.S. airstrikes will continue as part of an effort to protect U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. The U.S. has sent about 130 U.S. military personnel to northern Iraq to deal with a humanitarian crisis on Mount Sinjar. That is in addition to hundreds of U.S. troops already in Iraq to assist Iraqi forces in fighting Islamic State militants who have advanced across wide areas of northern Iraq recently. The rising U.S. military presence raised questions of whether the president was going to be able to keep his pledge to the American people that U.S. troops would not return to combat in Iraq. President Obama noted that U.S. efforts appear to have averted a humanitarian disaster without committing combat troops.
Well, the bottom line is that the situation on the mountain has greatly improved, and Americans should be very proud of our efforts because the skill and professionalism of our military and the generosity of our people. We broke the ISIL siege of Mount Sinjar, we helped vulnerable people reach safety, and we helped save many innocent lives.
Mr. Obama has said the U.S. will only assist Iraqis in their fight against militants. On Thursday, he repeated his calls for Iraqis of all sects to unite against the militants. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The Turkish Prime Minister's foreign policy toward jihadist groups like the Islamic State has strained relations with his Western allies, and once again the issue is being raised as Recep Tayyip Erdogan becomes Turkey's president. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, a change in policy may be in the offing.
İsrail devletinin Gazze'de, Filistin'de yaptığının soykırım değil de neyle izah edeceksiniz?
Last month, Mr. Erdogan bellowed to his supporters that Israel's military offensive in the Gaza Strip dwarfed the atrocities Hitler committed during World War II. And despite condemnation from both Europe and Washington, Mr. Erdogan continued to repeat these explosive remarks to rapturous applause from his conservative Muslim base. Turkey's allies have been increasingly concerned over Mr. Erdogan's outburst since last year's brutal crackdown on anti-government protests over plans to build on Gezi Park next to Istanbul's Taksim Square. But Sinan Ulgen, an analyst for the Carnegie Institute in Brussels, says with Mr. Erdogan's ascension to the presidency, he may be ready to change course.
He will try to improve his international image, an image that was tarnished over the past year, essentially, especially since Gezi. He will certainly have the opportunity to win back some of the trust that he lost in the past year in terms of his international standing.
The raging conflicts in Iraq and Syria, heightened by the sweeping gains of the radical group Islamic State, could offer President-elect Erdogan an opportunity to improve relations with his Western allies. Turkey shares borders with both Iraq and Syria, so it's seen by Western intelligence agencies as key to keeping tabs on jihadists, especially when they return home. But where Ankara's loyalties lie over radical Islamist groups like Islamic State is far from clear, says international relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadir Has University.
We have now enough stories and I think enough evidence that Turkey has played a role in the grooming of IS. They thought the more the merrier, that is, the more groups we have attacking the Bashar al-Assad regime. We've heard from people in the region and from IS people themselves how they could easily cross the borders and stuff, that it is now finally becoming more difficult. Because in words, and I guess in deeds too, it is, yes, changing its policy. Because it cannot sustain a dialogue with its allies, which after all, Turkey understood it needs.
Analysts say cooperation between Turkey and Western intelligence agencies has improved over monitoring Islamic State. They say that could be in part because Turkey is concerned over the repercussions of having backed jihadists. Also adding to Mr. Erdogan's apparent change in policy is concern over the 49 diplomats that the Islamist group took hostage when it seized the Iraqi city of Mosul. But international relations expert Özel says Ankara cannot fully move against the Islamic State for a few reasons.
IS basically holds Turkey hostage by holding actual 49 hostages. We don't know what the fate of the hostages is. If the reports are correct, 10% of IS fighters are Turkish. That means there are a lot of sympathizers, and I'm sure there are plenty of sympathizers. So you never know where there are some sleeper cells who may actually decide to commit a violent act in a major city.
Last month, many Turkish TV channels broadcast footage of scores of Islamic State members and supporters holding a gathering just outside Istanbul. Such an event sends a powerful message to President-elect Erdogan that if it moves against the jihadist group, he will have to reckon with the threat of retaliation and the fate of the Turkish hostages. But the reward could be an important step in rebuilding relations with Turkey's Western allies. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Still ahead, the Gaza ceasefire.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays on the Voice of America.
A new five-day ceasefire between Israel and Hamas held on Thursday after a brief exchange of fire the night before. VOA's Scott Bobb has more from Jerusalem.
Calm returned to Gaza and southern Israel after the exchange of rockets and airstrikes in the early morning hours Thursday. The Israeli military said it staged airstrikes against Palestinian militant targets in Gaza after at least eight rockets were fired into Israel. A statement said the rocket attacks began 2 hours before a three-day ceasefire expired. An official of Hamas, which controls Gaza, said its forces had not staged any such attacks and accused Israel of violating the ceasefire. The flare-up of violence came as Palestinian negotiator Azam Ahmed announced a five-day extension of the truce following 3 days of talks in Cairo. He said in the final moments it was agreed to extend the ceasefire for 5 more days. He added the ceasefire would begin at midnight Wednesday night and continue until Monday. He said Palestinian and Israeli negotiators had agreed on some points, but that some issues remained to be resolved. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev said Thursday that Israel had agreed to continue the temporary truce.
Israel has accepted the extension of the ceasefire. All along, we have been ready for an unconditional extension of the ceasefire. The problem has been Hamas. They are the wild card. They have violated or rejected 10 specific ceasefires, and we saw that again last night.
During the 5 weeks of conflict, more than 1,900 Palestinians were killed, mostly civilians, and some 10,000 others were wounded. 64 Israeli soldiers were killed, along with 3 civilians. Hamas says it would accept a truce if Israel ended its 7-year-old blockade of Gaza. Israel says Gaza must be demilitarized. Each side reportedly had agreed on measures to facilitate the movement of goods and people across the Gaza border. But they appeared to still be far apart on a Palestinian demand that an airport and seaport be allowed in the enclave and Israel's demand that Palestinian fighters disarm. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Nigerian officials confirmed Thursday a third Ebola death and one additional infection, raising fears there the disease is spreading geographically. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja the latest patient was diagnosed after she traveled to another state, and officials say they are now monitoring 6 people who had direct contact with her.
Fear of Ebola in Nigeria is in some ways more dangerous than Ebola itself. On Thursday, as officials confirmed the country's third Ebola death, local news reported that another person died from drinking large amounts of salt water on the erroneous belief that it would prevent or cure Ebola. Habu Ayoza teaches 8- and 9-year-olds at a private school in Kaduna, nearly 800 kilometers from Lagos, where Ebola patients are being treated. Parents and teachers, she says, are increasingly worried about sending their children back to school when classes resume in the coming weeks.
School is on holidays, so the parents are supposed to know that Ebola is all over the place. They are supposed to protect their children by keeping them at home for the meantime.
Ebola is transmitted through contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. There have been no known cases of Ebola in Kaduna so far. The most recently diagnosed Ebola patient, a health worker who cared for the Liberian American who originally brought the disease into Nigeria, traveled to Enugu, about 4 states away from Lagos State, before she developed symptoms. Nigerian Minister of Health, Onabuchi Chukwu, says after she fell ill, she was transported back to Lagos in a private ambulance.
So she got the disease in Lagos. Nobody in Enugu has Ebola virus disease. Before you go and say there's Ebola virus disease in Enugu, there is none. I repeat, there is no Ebola virus disease in Enugu.
He says the patient defied orders not to travel out of Lagos, as she was being observed after her contact with the first patient. Ebola has killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa this year, with all but three of the deaths in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. All of the countries have declared national emergencies, and Liberia has closed its borders. Nigerian Information Minister Laban Maku.
From the report we received from the 36 states, we have made a lot of progress in public sensitization and in preparing for any emergency. It is our belief and hope that there will be no emergency in another state or any state outside Lagos if the present efforts continue unabated, and they will continue unabated.
But parents fear the disease, wherever it is in the country, could also impact their children's education, as teachers fear the upcoming school semester. Teachers are vulnerable, says Ayoza in Kaduna, because they are exposed to children's mucus, sweat, and tears. This semester, she adds, students will be instructed to stay clean and not to shake hands or hug.
When you're the teacher, you always wash your hands. You teach the children how to wash their hands and how to keep their environments clean.
The Nigerian government has been communicating almost daily with the public, dispelling rumors and encouraging good hygiene. And while most Nigerians are still drinking regular water, locals say with no known cure for the disease and a more than 60% death rate, many people will continue to believe false promises like the saltwater cure. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
World Health Organization says it does not recommend a ban on air travel to and from Ebola-affected countries. The UN Health Agency says the risk of spreading the deadly disease in an airplane is extremely low. Korean Air announced Thursday it would suspend air travel to Kenya as of August 20th in order to prevent the spread of Ebola. First airline to take similar action was the Dubai carrier Emirates, which suspended air travel to Guinea back on August the 2nd. WHO Director of Alert and Response Isabel Nuttall says Ebola is not airborne like influenza or tuberculosis. She says the Ebola infection is passed on only through direct contact with a sick person's bodily fluid.
On the small chance that someone is sick on a plane, the likelihood of other passengers and crew contact with their body fluids is even smaller. A person infected with Ebola, a person can transmit the disease to another one only if he or she has the symptom of a disease: fever, vomiting, diarrhea. A person that has no sign of a disease is not contagious, is not transmitting the disease to others.
Dr. Nuttall says WHO recommends that airlines screen passengers going to or coming from Ebola-affected countries before allowing them to board the plane.
They need to be able and prepare to detect, investigate, as they would do, generally speaking, all year long for any disease that may occur. This is the purpose of international health regulation. Ensure that all countries do have the capacities to detect any event that is something serious, severe, and able to immediately provide adequate treatment for that person.
If someone is confirmed to have Ebola, Dr. Nuttall says that person would have to be isolated. World Health Organization says the perceived risk of catching Ebola is quite different from the real risk, which is very low. In other news, International Committee of the Red Cross says there still is time to avert a potentially catastrophic famine in Somalia, but only if donors act now to support critical humanitarian operations. Lisa Schlein reporting from the ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The government of Somalia has declared drought in seven regions. It warns there could be a repeat of the 2011 famine, where more than 250,000 people died, half of them children, unless urgent measures are taken to head off the worst. Eric Markley, the ICRC head of operations for East Africa, tells VOA that specialists on the ground do not see signs of widespread famine in Somalia right now. But he warns this situation could change.
If humanitarian aids, large-scale humanitarian aids, is slowed down or even worse, disrupted, the situation for the population will become unbearable, and we cannot exclude of having people dying of hunger.
Several factors are triggering the current crisis. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says drought in some areas and heavy rains and flooding in others are devastating Somalia's crop production, leading to severe food shortages. It says this also is causing a surge in food prices and a reduction in livestock production. Markley says ongoing conflict between the government and Al-Shabaab rebels is forcing people to flee their homes. This, he says, is disrupting their daily lives and having a long-term impact on livelihoods, agriculture, and livestock. The UN Refugee Agency reports 1.1 million people are internally displaced in Somalia. Markley says recent new waves of displacement are adding to this number. He says central and south Somalia are most seriously affected by climatic shocks and by violence. He says the ICRC has distributed food to more than 80,000 displaced and vulnerable people in areas affected by conflict or insecurity. He adds the agency is scaling up its humanitarian operations in Somalia to meet the increased and urgent nutritional needs of thousands of people there.
We are extending food, nutrition to a number of centers that we have, because indeed we observed on a daily basis new kids and mother coming to the center. So that brings this serious and severe malnutrition in Somalia. Indeed, children are at risk, elderly are at risk, weak and sick people are definitely at risk.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization reports more than 200,000 children under the age of 5 are acutely malnourished. It says nearly 3 million people in Somalia need urgent life-saving and livelihood support. International agencies agree donor countries must do more to help Somalia ward off the worst. Unfortunately, they say, the response to their appeals has been tepid. They warn only 29% of the money they need to mount critical humanitarian operations has been received, leaving a wide funding gap of $664 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The wife of actor-comedian Robin Williams says Parkinson's disease may have been a factor in her husband's apparent decision to commit suicide earlier this week. Susan Snyder on Thursday said her late husband was struggling with depression, anxiety, and the Parkinson's diagnosis when he was found dead Monday in their Northern California home. Snyder said her husband, who starred in many movies including Good Morning Vietnam, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Good Will Hunting, was in the early stages of the disease. She did not say when he was diagnosed. According to Snyder, Williams was not ready to share publicly that he had Parkinson's disease. There is no cure for Parkinson's. The nervous system disorder kills brain cells needed to control movement. Tremors are often among the early symptoms, which can result in rigid, halting walking, slowed speech, and dementia. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. If you find yourself on Twitter joining the conversation about what's happening around the world, look for me. I'm there at VOA Norman. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On August 15, 1914, the Panama Canal, connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, opened for traffic. One of the largest, most difficult engineering projects ever undertaken, the completion of the 77-kilometer-long waterway by American engineers had an enormous impact on shipping between the two oceans. It eliminated the necessity of traveling the long and treacherous route around the tip of South America. On this day in 1843, Tivoli Gardens, one of the oldest amusement parks in the world, opened in Copenhagen, Denmark. On this day in 1947, the British Parliament's Indian Independence Bill came into force, carving the independent nations of India and Pakistan out of the former Mughal Empire. And on this day in 1969, a huge outdoor rock festival called Woodstock opened in the rural town of Bethel, New York. Its promoters billed the event as 3 days of peace and music and hoped to draw a crowd of 150,000. Instead, nearly a 500,000 young people showed up.
Turn the guitar off, Mike, please. Guitar, Mike.
At Woodstock, that's Richie Havens singing Freedom. The massive crowds, a critical lack of services, and rainstorms could have spelled disaster, yet in tune with the idealistic hopes of the 1960s, Woodstock satisfied most attendees who raved about the sense of social harmony and the music of 32 of the biggest acts in rock music. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much of the history of the 21st century is going to be written right here in Asia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said at the U.S.-ASEAN ministerial meeting recently held in Burma. ASEAN is at the center of the Asia-Pacific region's multilateral architecture, and it plays a critical role in promoting both peace, prosperity, and also a regional integration throughout Asia. The United States remains deeply committed to engaging the Asia-Pacific region. ASEAN, in our judgment, is fundamental to our being able to uphold a rules-based system in the Asia-Pacific and ensuring that all countries, big and small, have a say in how we work together, Secretary Kerry said. We're strengthening our people-to-people ties through President Barack Obama's Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative, which provides critical leadership in development and networking in ASEAN. We're supporting the formation of the ASEAN Economic Community in 2015, which will sustain the prosperity of the ASEAN region. We're also working closely together to protect the environment. We recognize the tremendous economic dynamism of this region and its people, he continued. We also recognize our shared prosperity demands a renewed commitment to sustainable economic growth. That is why we're focused not only on growing our countries and making them stronger, but on also growing fair and just societies, particularly countries with clean air, clean water, and shared river resources for all Southeast Asian nations. The United States and ASEAN have a common responsibility in maintaining peace and stability on the high seas and to ensure the maritime security that is critical to global trade. Secretary Kerry stressed the importance of managing tensions in the South China Sea on the basis of international law. This means voluntarily agreeing to refrain from actions that would complicate or escalate disputes. It's no understatement that what happens here matters not just to this region and to the United States, Secretary Kerry said. It matters to everybody in the world to see a Southeast Asia that continues to grow based on rules-based international law.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.